Revolving District Court for the Village and Shire of Vulcanvania is now in order. The Honorable Reeve Alvin Vulcanizer presides.
Okay, Dennis, what do we got here? Diabolical panel of peril? With spoilers for the movie, nothing but trouble?
Now listen!
Okay, we'll listen.
This is Diabolical, the comedy podcast that dissects films' most dastardly schemes, then competes to improve them. I'm your host, Gaz, and this week's movie is Dan Aykroyd's infamous 1991 directorial debut come swan song, Nothing But Trouble. So, Peril Pals, fire up Mr. Bone Stripper, strap yourselves in for one literal hell of a roller coaster ride, and let's get diabolical! Hello and welcome to the pod. Joining me on the panel of peril this week are Adam.
Hello.
Ben.
Hello.
Craig.
Hello.
And our very special guest, the host of Junk Filter Pod, Jesse Hawken.
Good evening.
Good evening. Are you well?
Oh yeah, I'm ready to rumble.
Oh good.
That's that intro. I guess you're ready to rumble.
Yeah. You set the table. And now it's time to eat.
Psyched you up. You ready to flay some flesh?
We'll send the condiment train around.
Oh, God.
Now, as with all our guest panel members, we're required to conduct a psychological test to determine just how diabolical you are. I'll hand you over to our resident evil expert, Ben, who has some questions for you. And just to clarify, he is our resident expert on evil and not an expert on Resident Evil.
Thanks for the clarification there. As Gaz says, Jesse, this is the part of the show where we ask some scientifically determined questions to find out just how diabolical you are.
Did you call up some of my old girlfriends? Is that what you're
talking about? I've done a lot of research. It's a bit like a Rorschach test. So just please answer honestly with the first thing that pops in your head. Blockbuster or indie?
Blockbuster.
Yeah.
Okay. Soundtrack or score?
Soundtrack.
I like that we haven't asked you to elaborate on any of this. Like, you might answer in a David Lynch style. Just shut us down.
Physical or digital?
Physical. Let's get physical, as Olivia Newton-John once said.
Okay. Comics or novels?
Novels.
Okay. Do you have a particular favorite?
No, I don't have a particular favorite, but I have a reputation on Twitter for being hard on comics, even though I like comics. Mm. If I had to choose one or the other, though, I'm choosing a novel. I'm a grown-up.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, next question. Gags or puns?
Puns. Easily.
Oh, you're going to like this show, then.
Mm-hmm. Or not.
Yeah, I've been like warned by friends of mine that our friendship is about to end because of some of the puns I've told. So
you have found a new family here.
Fries and mayo, a heavenly delicacy or the dictionary definition of an abomination?
I've come around to fries with mayo.
Yeah, I always liked it.
I can accept it now. I used to think that was disgusting. You know what's really good, though, is ketchup and mayo together with fries.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Ketchnaise.
Ketchnaise, yeah.
Now you're talking.
Ketchnaise, yes.
Do you remember the Mr. Show sketch about mayonnaise and mustard mixed together? And it's
mayo, mustard, mayonnaise, or whatever.
Mayo-rested mayonnaise.
But that's a real product in Canada now. They actually introduced mayo and mustard together.
Wow.
That sounds good.
Together at last.
I don't know if they'd ever seen the Mr. Show or not.
Okay, you have the ungodly power to bring back one cancelled TV show. What do you pick?
I don't know if you guys know about Bunheads, but that's the show I would bring back. Bunheads was this show by the people that did Gilmore Girls. They did this show about ballet dancers, and nobody watched it, but it was a really great show. I went in skeptically. I know that Gilmore Girls is not... I don't know. Do you guys in the UK know about Gilmore Girls?
Yeah. Gilmore Girls is how I became a woman.
Yep.
They screened Gilmore Girls on Channel 4 in the UK, and I caught it one day. I guess I was intrigued because it had Sylvester Stallone's son from Rocky Balboa in it.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'll watch this. He was in Heroes. That was pretty good. And then, every day then I would have my coffee and a small cake of some kind, and I would watch Gilmore Girls religiously. I absolutely loved it. And yeah. I watched the Netflix revival too. I thought it was decent. I wanted to call our kid Rory, but I wasn't allowed. So,
well, Gilmore Girls is when Gilmore Girls was new. If you were a guy and you said that you liked Gilmore Girls, I joked that it would be like telling your friends that you had just enrolled in a jazz dancing class. Like, people would just think you were out of your mind, but they'd never actually watch the show. It's a great show. Anyway, the creator of that show, before she did The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, made this show about young dancers called Bunheads. You might be able to find it on Disney Plus over there.
I'm gonna look for
I was like, okay, let's watch this show. And the first two episodes, I was like, I'm not really feeling this show. And then several episodes in, I started getting hooked on it. And then by the final episode, I was like, this show is amazing. And then it got canceled. Hmm. So that if I had power to return a show, it would be Bunheads.
Is that right? That second show hump, isn't it? Nobody else went past it, and that's why it didn't make it. But I'm going
to
watch it.
Yeah, but I'm supposed to be diabolical at the end of this test, so I don't know if Bunheads is going to buy me back some points.
Well, we'll see.
I think they all think I'm pretty evil, and they knew I like Gilmore Girls, right?
Right. For 1,000 five-star reviews a month for the next year, all you have to do is pose for a Burt Reynolds-style photo shoot. You know the one I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. What do you do?
I would do it because I get a lot of requests, especially on Twitter these days. A lot of women write me and say pussy and bio and things like that. Like, they're coming on to me. So I feel like there must be a demand out there for me lounging around in the nude. So I would do it. If these ladies are any indication of the interest out there, then I would.
Have you seen the Tom Jones one that's going around? It's a cover of like Playgirl or something where he's in a Speedo, but somebody has airbrushed the Speedo out so it just looks like there's nothing there, just more hair.
Yeah. I saw Tom Jones live in Toronto, and there was this really funny moment where women were throwing their underwear at him during the show, and he passed one pair of panties back and said, "I hope you don't catch cold." Which was really gross, but at one point, so he was introducing the green grass of home, and he was telling a story about being a young boy in Wales, and all these women were like, "We love you," and like screaming over him, and he looked at one of them and he said, "I'll get to you in a minute."
It's how we all talk in Wales. That's standard.
Right, to guarantee the world a great new Star Wars story, all you have to do is publicly pin the blame for episode 9 on an unsuspecting 5-year-old. What do you do?
I would definitely find a 5-year-old and ruin his life so that we could get one more good Star Wars movie.
So worth it. Right, the final question. Who needs taking down a peg or two?
Who needs taking down a peg or two? Like, who's been having too easy a time of it and needs to be taken down? Let's go after Taylor Swift. She's got a new album out.
Yes. Good.
Taylor Swift gets enough online hate, I think. She doesn't need any more from us.
She's had it too easy for too long. This morning they announced that her album was a double album, and I felt bad for all the nerds that bought the album thinking that it was just going to be one record. Now they have to buy it again to get the bonus records. Maybe they're fine with that and they would have done it anyway, but I just think, you know, that's cruel.
Well, they've been reissuing Beatles albums for years, and people keep buying them. So, you know, it's just, there's a market for it. They keep doing it.
But yeah, I know that Taylor's got a lot of shooters out there, so I don't know. Maybe I've just brought a great deal of trouble on myself.
She's all right. She's a billionaire now anyway, isn't she? So, you know, she can suck it up.
I'm just going to publicly distance myself from that just in case.
That's right.
Yeah, poor billionaires. Poor.
I do lose some sympathy for anybody who becomes a billionaire.
I just wanted to make somebody's comfortable life uncomfortable, if only for a moment.
All right. Well, I'm totting up the results there. And yeah, you've got some diabolical elements, but you've also got a softer side, I think, that we've seen.
That's why I wanted to go after Taylor Swift, so that I could try to get some points
back. Well, that,
I'm like that recommending bunheads and stuff. Like, that's not really evil genius behavior, is it?
Yeah. And so for those answers, and particularly for the Burt Reynolds style photo shoot, you are getting 7 florets of evil broccoli.
I can deal with that.
Is that good?
That's one less than Nenemy. It is 3 more than David Quantic.
Was it?
But not as evil as Matt Spectro.
He's pretty evil.
He was pretty evil. Yeah, he's pretty dastardly.
He made us watch Krell.
Now, let's hear from Craig with a synopsis of this week's movie.
A commercial and critical flop, Dan Aykroyd's sole directorial outing has cultivated a reputation as a must-watch among what King Kim Newman once dubbed the clag buffs, those esoteric film fans who love nothing more than digging through the bargain bins for the cheapest, nastiest horror films and enjoying the ensuing car crash. While Aykroyd was inspired to script a comedy horror after witnessing audiences laughing at a screening of Hellraiser, he never intended to direct and only felt pressured to do so after the chance was passed on by the likes of Johns, Hughes and Landis, and it seemed like nobody else wanted to touch it. Originally titled Git, later renamed Road to Ruin, and most famously, Valkenvania, Aykroyd's ostensible auteur production is nonetheless fascinating, intriguingly tasteless, and for me at least, oddly enjoyable. The working title, Trick House, aptly described where much of the $45 million budget must have gone, with the wacky, dilapidated Valkenheiser mansion full of secret passageways, tricks and gadgets, coming off as impressively high concept, and its central feature, the deadly roller coaster ride that strips its passengers to the bone, a fitting metaphor for the experience of watching this tonally messy, yet endearingly ambitious movie. But what did the panel of peril make of it? And let's start with our guest, Jesse Hawken. Now, Jesse, you and I discussed your pick via DM on X. It's all happening on X, folks. And I'm intrigued to hear what made you choose this movie. But also, you shocked me by noting that this was based on a true story.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie that it was like a what were they thinking movie when it came out in 1991. Like, yeah. It looked and sounded so abysmal. as did another movie from the 90s that's a comedy that horrifies people, Clifford, with Martin right, Short.
Yeah. Where he plays a kid.
And Charles Grodin. Yeah, like that's you might want to pencil that in for your program because he's yeah. he's like an evil man child in that film. But you have to wonder what people were thinking that this would be like a good movie to spend a lot of money on.
Yeah.
But Clifford is actually a really funny movie. And people have started to realize how funny it is over time.
Charles Grodin could make anything funny. And Martin yeah. Short, for that matter.
Yeah. But Nothing But Trouble is like this big, gigantic question mark of a movie. Like, I have no idea who this was for. And this was also a movie that actually, like, destroyed some careers.
Yeah.
Like, Chevy Chase was in a movie every year, basically, since the late 70s. You got at least one Chevy Chase movie a year. After Nothing But Trouble, he went away. You know? And Dan Aykroyd, this is his one and only film as a filmmaker. But what's crazy about it is it's like getting into a glimpse into the mind of Dan Aykroyd is what I love about this movie. Mm. Even if it's not a good movie, this is a very personal project.
Yeah.
This obviously means a lot to him. And what really sealed the deal for me in terms of having some bizarre respect for this film was finding out that it's actually based on a true story.
Yeah.
And I can tell this story. Aykroyd, when he was working on Saturday Night Live, he was maintaining a farm that he lived on in Kingston, Ontario, about 3 hours away from Toronto. And he used to drive from the farm through New York State to Manhattan when he was working on Saturday Night Live in like one of his many custom cars. And he was driving through this sleepy little town in New York State and he got hit with a speeding ticket. The cop told him that he had to come with him to the local justice of the peace to immediately take care of this, this speeding ticket. So he was brought to this mansion that was way the hell out in, you know, rural New York State. And the judge was a justice of the peace who was an ancient, I think it was an old lady, but he was hit with a $50 fine. And then he was asked to stay for dinner and for to have some tea with the judge. He wound up being there for 4 hours. She wouldn't. And they just wound up talking. And he kind of left this situation being very confused. Like, why did this just happen to me? Why was I taken to this old judge's house in the middle of nowhere and made to stay for hours on end?
Wow.
So it kind of traumatized him. And when they were coming up with the idea for this sort of horror comedy, which was something that Aykroyd had already done arguably with Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
He was obsessed with making a comedy monster movie like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein kind of stuff. And so his original treatment for Ghostbusters was as crazy as this movie is.
Right.
Like, this is like, if nobody had said no to him while he was making Ghostbusters, this is what would have resulted.
Yeah.
So Warner Brothers really wanted to work with Dan Aykroyd, and they wanted another hit. And Aykroyd had just been nominated for an Oscar 2 years earlier for Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, right.
So he was kind of a hot property still. Yeah. And he didn't want to direct this movie, but he wound up directing it. And they decided to make this horror comedy that was loosely based on this weird experience that he'd had with this crazy judge. And what's also nuts about Vulcanvania, the town, is that it's actually based on a real town in Pennsylvania named Centralia, which has had a coal mine fire that's been burning since 1962 and is still burning today.
Like the Simpsons tire fire. Wow. It's just eternal.
Yeah, it was this, there was like a catacomb of all these underground mines in northern Pennsylvania, and there had been a fire that might have started in the 30s, but in the 60s it caught fire and burned down the town, and the town evacuated, and they have not been able to put out the fire. There's a moment in Nothing But Trouble where Dan Aykroyd puts his stick in the ground and pulls it up, and it's there's a the molten lava underneath. That's basically what it's like in this town.
Yeah.
And so everybody moved out of this town, and the whole region is now owned by the state of Pennsylvania.
I think like five people live there, like just hanging on.
Yeah. In the 2020 census, they said that there were five people there. One of them is under 18. The other four are people who just won't move, like sort of sovereign nation kind of, I'm not moving, you know, sort of thing. So so the town is basically waiting for these people to die, and then they'll take over their property. But like, just imagine a fire that's been burning for 60 years.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's so crazy. So the weird thing about Nothing But Trouble is it's based on true events.
And also Dan Aykroyd's dreams partly as well, I heard.
Yes.
Yeah, which is very, it's a very Dan Aykroyd thing to do. Yeah, speaking of Dan Aykroyd kind of being given carte blanche on this, I saw an interview with him and Chase on Arsenio where Dan Aykroyd said of Chevy Chase that he was his creative conscience, and he told him to have faith in his vision. So it seemed like Chevy was kind of egging him on, and I don't know whether he was doing that as a joke, because that seems like the sort of thing Chevy Chase might do for fun. But also, he apparently, as a first-time director, probably coming at it from an actor's perspective, he allowed every actor on set to have their own playback monitor until John Hughes visited the set, took one look at it and said, you can't have this set up, and just shut the whole thing down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many of the actors were given the permission to come up with their own dialogue.
Right.
One reason why there's no memorable lines of dialogue in this movie.
I didn't get a single memorable line down, which is a regular feature.
I thought it was some good ones, actually.
For a horror comedy, it's not funny or particularly horrific. It's grotesque, but it's you wouldn't call it horror.
Well, we think maybe that's down to cuts, and that maybe it was more grotesque originally, more violent. I think Jesse said that it didn't originally have a PG-13 rating.
Yeah, the other funny thing about this is it was being made at the same time that Warner Brothers was making The Bonfire of the Vanities with Brian De Palma.
Yeah,
how ironic.
Which is a legendary troubled production.
Yeah.
It costs a little bit more than Nothing But Trouble, which cost $40 million.
Yeah.
The one thing you can say about Nothing But Trouble, though, is you see all that money on the screen, because this movie is not very funny, but it is a memorable viewing experience because of all the care and attention that went into making it.
Yeah.
It's got the great cinematographer Dean Cundey, who shot The Thing.
Yeah.
So he knows a little something about body horror, filming body horror properly. And he filmed Back to the Future. He had just come off Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Roadhouse. After Nothing But Trouble, he shot Hook and Jurassic Park and Jack and Jill. Speaking of movies with actors playing two roles that are in the same shot. So, you know, he's a gifted cinematographer. And the production designer, William Sandell, was the guy who worked on RoboCop and Total Recall. Yeah. And then he was Oscar nominated.
Master and Commander.
Yeah, for Master and Commander. So all these pros are working on this movie. And and all the stories from the set are very favorable to how welcoming Aykroyd was for suggestions and ideas. Anybody who had an idea on the set from the gaffers and the lighting assistants to the cast had ideas that got incorporated into the movie.
Yeah.
So very generous. But Warner Brothers was like having weekly meetings with Aykroyd saying, knock it off. What's going on here? But they were actually more concerned about how badly the Bonfire of the Vanities was going.
Yeah.
So they kind of left Aykroyd alone for the most part, except for the occasional lecture. But when they saw the finished results, they said, oh, my God. And they had to postpone the release of the film. They had to cut some violence out. They had to cut some language out because it was going to get an R rating. They moved the Bonfire of the Vanities into the Christmas slot and shoved Nothing But Trouble down into February of 1991. It opened on the same day as The Silence of the Lambs and got steamrolled at the box office. Yeah. So gigantic. I think it made $8 million. It cost $40
though. Yeah, I think it ballooned.
Wow. To give you guys an example of the amount of ridiculous expenditure on this film, do you remember that we spoke earlier about the condiment train that was set up on that table?
Right.
Yeah.
That cost $25,000 to make.
I think it was worth it.
They had to find a beautiful old table, and they had to make a train circle around it. They had to build a contraption for that sequence, and it had to run and electronics and stuff like that. This was like an idea that somebody on the crew had. Like, why don't we have a train going around with condiments? Great idea. $25,000 later.
It was funny, though.
Yeah.
Maybe Chevy's back pills showed up to the set of Nothing But Trouble, and that's what happened.
Yeah. And the studio didn't know what the fuck Vulcanvania is, so right. they changed the name to Nothing But Trouble, which doesn't sound very interesting.
Just a throwaway line of dialogue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Demi Moore says it briefly.
A line of dialogue that's ADR, too.
There's a lot of ADR.
The line is delivered so offhandedly.
Yeah.
You wouldn't say, oh, we've got to name the movie Nothing But Trouble after that great line of dialogue.
That's the title.
So just a train wreck. I didn't see it for years. And then when I finally watched it, I was like, you know, the thing about this movie is, He's got something here. There's like, it's not a good movie, but it is a glimpse into the mind of Dan Aykroyd, who's like a famous weirdo. Right. And it's fun to see nobody saying no to him and letting him do whatever the hell he wants to try and make a movie that even he described as Beetlejuice meets the Texas Chainsaw Massacre as a comedy, though.
I want to take that to the nth degree and see all the stuff that was cut. I think that would be even more interesting. Even if it's worse, I just need to see it.
I want to know what the bone stripper scene was like before they made some cuts. Like, was it gorier at one point? Mr. Bone Stripper is this roller coaster that starts in the house and then goes to a basically a gigantic wood chipper machine that cuts the people that the judge sentences to death. It cuts them up into ribbons, and you see all the bones being spat out of a of a tube
and hitting a target with a comedy noise.
Yeah, it's actually very disturbing material. Like, I don't think grown-ups would be freaked out by this movie, but I think children would be.
Oh, for sure.
Maybe that is what he had in mind. I did notice that Mr. Bone Stripper, it has some water jets cleaning the cutting devices. So I wondered if maybe in an uncut version, they're drenched in blood and then cleaned off by this kind of spray.
But what's even grosser is they insinuate that you see the Mr. Bone Stripper taking care of some drug dealers. And then a couple of scenes later, they are all sitting around this big table eating hot dogs that look disgusting. And we can presume that those are the people that got put through Mr. Bone Stripper.
Right. Yeah, because they're so poor, they have to eat the prisoners. They don't have anything else.
And ants on the log, of course.
Ants on the log.
Ants on the log.
That's a great line.
Yeah.
Somebody was revulsed by the idea of the condiment train earlier. I forget. Was it Ben? I saw you wincing.
Yeah, it was horrible. That was a horrible watch. It's dripping off the dog.
I think one of the condiments on that hot dog, the one that Dan Aykroyd eats, has shrimp cocktail on it as a condiment.
Yeah. And it's got this little dangly part to it where they cut the sausages. So revolting. And you also get a brief glimpse of Dan Aykroyd eating it, and his nose looks like a penis during that scene. I don't know if you all noticed that or not.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that is hilarious. What I like about that is the fact that, because we see him remove the nose later.
Yeah.
Right. So we find out it's a fake nose. So obviously the insinuation there is that the judge has purposely picked a nose that's shaped like a penis.
Right.
Or worse, it is a penis
that
he puts on his face.
It's come out of Mr. Bone Stripper. It's Billy Baldwin or whichever Baldwin.
Daniel Baldwin.
Daniel Baldwin.
Oh, my God. Anyway, so a giant what were they thinking movie. And like the reviews at the time ranged from this movie isn't very funny to what the fuck is a movie like this being released for?
Yeah.
Did you hear the Roger Ebert story?
I heard his review.
He hated the movie, but at the screening, there were some people laughing and talking during the movie. And he went over to them and asked them to speak up and be louder so he didn't have to hear the movie.
Wow.
Did he refuse to review it in the end?
No, he reviewed it.
I think eventually he did review it, and he did a review of it on Siskel and Ebert, but he refused to review it for the Chicago Sun-Times.
Right. Okay. He said on the TV show, he said it was so relentlessly grotesque and unfunny that kind of what we've said, you look at it and you wonder who is this for, because it's not funny, so it doesn't work on that level. But I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought bits of it were funny, and it's a good looking movie. And we said earlier as well, the level of talent around Aykroyd, and this is probably the reason for this, but it's a good looking movie. The set design is fantastic.
Yeah,
the set decorator was a guy called Michael Taylor. I forgot to look at what else he's done, but the makeup guy David Miller was the guy who did Freddy Krueger. And the makeup on Dan Aykroyd is undeniably fantastic.
It's very good, yeah. Especially the way his eyes come through.
Oh, my God. And Aykroyd was also directing the movie while wearing the disguises. Right. So, like, imagine this out-of-control production. Because he plays two parts. He also plays, like, this man-baby at one point. So,
oh, he's one of those, yeah. That's right.
Bobo.
I was looking around to see if there were any production photos of him as the man-baby, like, with looking into the viewfinder.
I hope he stayed in character when he was giving direction as Bobo.
Well, I said how he described Chevy Chase. So in that same interview, Chase tells Arsenio that working with Dan Aykroyd as a director was like working with Rommel on peyote. So
he should talk, though, because Chevy Chase is a legendary asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More than one of the actors who worked on this movie said that Chase was mean to them on the set, and he had temper tantrums. And apparently he used to also phone members of the crew in the middle of the night to apologize to them for his behavior that day.
Wow.
He's got problems. Yeah.
I think he's one of these guys, and we all kind of know them from school, who his style of humor is that cutting humor, and it's kind of mean. But because it always gets a rise out of people and gets a laugh from certain types of people, he got so used to the, you know, that giddy thrill of, oh, people are laughing at me, that when he came to stuff like SNL, his style of being mean carries over into that. And he doesn't know when to turn it off, I think, is his problem. Mm-hmm. Jesse told me to watch his roast, and it's just a tragedy. None of his friends are there. And the people who are there, you know, people like Stephen Colbert, like a really nice guy, are just horrible to him. it's just an awful watch. And at the end of it, he just looks really sad.
Walks off like Charlie Brown.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I read an interview with Chase where he said that after the taping of the roast, he went back to his hotel and cried for hours.
Yeah.
Because it basically hit him like a ton of bricks that he has no friends and everyone hates him.
Right. And the MC is the guy from Letterman, the Paul.
Yeah, it was Paul Schaefer. Paul Schaefer. Yeah, he had to give him like a pep talk afterwards.
Right. Yeah.
They were just telling all these jokes about his pills for his back pain, which were available in powdered form that he was taking all the time. And they're just like calling him an alcoholic and a loser and a, you know, like a cokehead and untalented. And you know the famous Bill Murray insult, right?
Yeah. Medium talent.
Yeah. They were backstage at Saturday Night Live and they were having this shoving match and he just yelled medium talent at him.
And I think that's really telling. That's more cutting to him than anything else anyone could have said. And I think the real tragedy of the roast isn't the things that people are saying about him. It's that none of his friends are there. Even Steve Martin, Martin Short, they show up on a VT. They weren't there. And they do like a bit about them filming Three Amigos 2 with Nathan Lane instead of Chevy Chase.
God, I'd have watched that.
Yeah.
Sure. He also hosted Saturday Night Live like about 8 or 9 times, but the last time he hosted the show, he was banned from the show forever. I think he's appeared on reunion specials and stuff, but they told him his conduct and cruelty towards the cast were so awful that he was told that he will never host the show again.
Wow. Three Amigos, though, I would say that's his wheelhouse. He's very good in Three Amigos.
I like Fletch. The first Fletch is good.
Yeah, the first Fletch is good. Yeah.
I think he's an acquired taste, Chevy Chase. And I don't think I've ever quite acquired it. Yeah. I don't really see the appeal of him, to be honest. And
Completely, but I think that's the appeal of Three Amigos to me, is that his part in Three Amigos is he's meant to be the character who's a dick. Do you remember when they're trekking through the desert and they're all thirsty and he's got the only canteen of water?
Yeah,
and he's like pouring it all over swilling himself his and mouth like spits it out.
Yeah, and he's like moisturizing his face with it.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's how they see him.
Chase isn't very good in this movie, by the way.
No.
I think he was giving the bare minimum energy.
Yeah, he's phoning it in, isn't he? Yeah.
Aykroyd is fully committed, though.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And John Candy. John Candy's fantastic.
John Candy is the...
Yeah, in both roles.
Really? Brilliant. He's a god. I love John Candy.
I thought he was just not interested in this movie.
Really? He didn't want to do it. I know that much.
Yeah, that's it. Chevy Chase, they just went, do you want to do a movie? He went, yeah, fine.
It was more like he was so regretful about not doing Ghostbusters that he felt like he had to do this and that it would be a career misstep not to do it. Mm-hmm. Even I think during filming though he was kind of reconsidering that. Mm-hmm. Another hilarious bit from that interview on Arsenio is Arsenio opens right away. He just doesn't say hello to Dan Aykroyd or anything. He says, how did you get Candy to play a woman? And Dan Aykroyd as well. He says it's a proper character building role, you know, it's not a cheap drag act. And he says, this is verbatim what he says of this. It's a really tasty way to play a woman.
It reminds me of when Bugs Bunny dresses up as a woman.
Yeah.
Just seen John Candy as a woman, very much so, the way he plays it.
It reminded me of Divine in the John Waters movies a little bit too. He's not as over the top.
Yeah.
Because Candy plays the female part wordlessly. But with that sort of campy eyebrow, lots of eyebrow acting, and you know, she's a good-looking woman too. You know, like Candy plays a babe in the film.
Yeah.
But I also love Candy's cop character, the super.
Yeah.
We recognize that as the super polite Canadian voice of reason that he's doing all the time. Like, well, you see, kind of like talking. Yeah. Like Candy was just so good at that. But Candy, he was mad that he passed on Ghostbusters. The Lewis Tully character was developed after Candy turned down the role. They sort of customized it for Moranis.
Yeah.
But one of the stories from the set was that when he came down dressed as the woman and everyone was wolf whistling him, he said something like, the things you'll do for $1 million.
Right.
And speaking of money that people were making on the project, Chevy Chase was also yelling at Aykroyd because he said that he was making more money starring in the movie than Aykroyd was making writing, directing, starring, and playing a second role in the movie.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons he took the director's gig, or the way he explained it to the studio, was this will save us on the director's fee. So he wasn't even taking a fee for directing it, which is crazy.
What a bug.
And it still went, it ran over 5 million. So it actually went up to 45 million in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Even with that concession,
it's nicely directed. In all fairness,
it is
for a debut feature. I say, surrounded himself with the right people and took advice. But I'd watch another film by Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah,
maybe with someone else reining him in.
Well, the crew loved Aykroyd and they loved working with him. And at the beginning, Aykroyd admitted that he didn't really know what he was doing, and the crew were always offering suggestions and tips. And like Demi Moore even suggested, you know, when I have my entrance, when the elevator door opens, you should cut to slow motion and I'll walk, you know, lasciviously out of the elevator. So you should slow down the film for that scene and stuff like that. So like even the cast were giving him tips on how to make a good movie, but he started getting more confident as it went along.
Yeah, it makes sense.
But this is again a movie that where they're just so far up their own asses making this movie that the finished results, Warner Brothers was like, all hands on deck, panic, you know, like they couldn't just not put this movie out. That's the sort of thing Warner Brothers does these days.
Yeah.
But, you know, they had to put it out.
Maybe that is what has inspired David Zaslav's whole approach to business. He saw this movie and he's like, well, I know what I'm going to do when I get into Warner Brothers.
Have any of you guys seen the new Ghostbusters?
Gaz has.
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen it as well, yeah.
I loved Aykroyd in it.
Yes.
One of the reasons why I wanted to do the Nothing But Trouble show when Craig reached out to me was that I went in on a Dan Aykroyd renaissance after watching Ghostbusters, because I was expecting him to phone it in and just be there like Bill Murray. But he was totally in and loving playing Ray Stantz as an older man, and he had a lot of screen time, and I was like, I miss Dan Aykroyd. I wish that he were in more movies.
Yeah, Ghostbusters is really his baby. He was trying to get Ghostbusters 3 made forever, and Bill Murray just wouldn't do it. Unless he was a ghost, I think it was his stipulation.
Yeah.
And then they made the video game, and they all came back for that, and apparently that is kind of a spiritual Ghostbusters 3, but I haven't been able to bring myself around to playing it yet.
That was kind of the time before studios became obsessed with existing IP and franchise filmmaking.
Right.
So it was quite a big reason. And it was a massive budget as well. As I recall, his concept was about hell rising up through the earth.
Right, yeah.
They just weren't willing at that time to spend that kind of money on Ghostbusters, which was a dead franchise.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you get a sense of that kind of ambition in Nothing But Trouble. Like,
absolutely.
The ending of Nothing But Trouble, where the coal fire actually bursts into life and destroys everything. Right. That was pretty impressive, I thought. There were some good fireball explosions. I don't know how safe they were. But
Well, John Landis didn't direct, so probably quite safe.
That's true. Yeah, he was. In a way, they were lucky that Landis passed on making this.
Mm.
And Landis made Blues Brothers 2000, so it wasn't like quality. It wasn't good enough quality for him or anything.
Yeah.
And Beverly Hills Cop 3 was his as well, wasn't it?
Beverly Hills Cop 3, yes.
Mm. I think that was the fault of Eddie Murphy, though, wasn't it? He refused to make it a comedy. He was like, no, Axel Foley's a grown-up now. He's not funny anymore.
Okay. Well, around the time of Beverly Hills Cop 2, Murphy told a funny joke where he said that Vic Morrow has as much of a chance of working with Landis again as I do.
Ay, ay, ay.
That's very Eddie Murphy.
But then years later, they worked together on Beverly Hills Cop 3. So there might have been an awkward moment at the beginning of that.
That also is very Eddie Murphy.
What did everyone think of that kind of Looney Tunes ending?
Running through the wall.
So good.
Yeah. It plays throughout the film, doesn't it? All the Looney Tunes stuff. There's the sound effects and like we said, John Candy. So it does fit, but it's an odd one.
It is really Looney Tunes-like. I'm surprised Chevy Chase didn't fall madly in love with the female John Candy.
Eyes popping up.
But it's filmed like a cartoon, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's not visually appealing. That's what is another thing that's so great about this movie. It's ugly all the time. Even though so much time and energy has gone into art direction, the results are actually hard to look at.
The Hellraiser thing must have played into the design of Bobo and Little Devil. They are like Cenobites.
Mm-hmm. They come out of nowhere, those characters, don't they?
Yeah, seemingly.
No rhyme or reason, they just appear.
They're adult babies.
I thought they were nude at first, too.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
But then there's a scene where we can see they're wearing shorts, thank God.
Yeah. I think they're diapers, aren't they?
Yeah, I thought they were nappies.
Oh, yeah. Well, at least they're big nappies.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And the judge himself looks like the grandpa from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like so horrible. That scene where he's looking at him through the peephole and he's removing his nose and his... disgusting.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't think I did mention it earlier, but the film this reminded me of was, do you remember High Spirits with Peter O'Toole and Steve Guttenberg?
Mm-hmm.
Just had that kind of tone, and that wasn't very good either.
There was another bad comedy from the 80s called Haunted Honeymoon with Gene Wilder and Gilda Radner.
Oh, wow.
And Dom DeLuise is in that, and he's in drag in that movie too. So this movie bears a striking resemblance to that one.
Probably influenced by a few things like that, because I can just imagine Dan Aykroyd being into all that. Anything to do with ghosts, I think he's obsessed.
Didn't Dan Aykroyd have his own paranormal investigation show for a while there? I'm sure I remember seeing it.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm surprised that Dan Aykroyd hasn't gone QAnon. Mm. You think that he would love QAnon.
Just seen the type.
I guess he's been involved in Hollywood too long, and he would just know if that was a thing, he'd know about it by now.
That's true.
Any kind of conspiracy involving celebrities, he probably knows. He knows much worse things than that.
For me, what puts Aykroyd's character into the sort of diabolical category is when you consider his body count.
Yeah.
When there's that scene where they go up into the attic And you see all the driver's licenses of all the people that he's killed. And
Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy Hoffa
that include Jimmy Hoffa and like a bus full of Hare Krishnas. And, you know, because he's like judge, jury, and executioner. Like, but he has a particular hatred for bankers.
Yeah.
Right. Due to a bad coal deal.
That's a peculiar little thing that Chevy Chase's character at the start of the film says that his father was involved in coal stocks. And Falkenhayn, his grandfather was ripped off on coal stocks, but they don't knit the two together in any way.
I thought it was going to come round.
You'd think they would.
Bet they did. There's so much missing material from this, I'm sure. Because of, you know, just the way that they were allowed to work on this makes me feel like they must have shot hundreds of hours, you know. Not literally hundreds, but a lot more than made the cut, I'm certain.
When a movie with this much happening in it and that much production design in it comes in at a brisk 91 minutes, that's like 4 minutes of credits too. That suggests the studio said,
Hashtag release the Aykroyd cut.
Nobody cares about the grudge that the Falkenhayn has against Chevy Chase's dad. You know, let's just put this puppy to bed. Let's finish this 90-minute movie. We're going to lose a shitload of money on it. We don't care. And Aykroyd also said that the reason why this movie didn't do well was because of the competition and because of the Gulf War.
That explains
He blamed this movie not doing well because of the Gulf War.
Yeah, nobody wants to see fossil fuels being burned when the Gulf War is going on.
Yeah, they weren't ready for a movie about oil-rich maniacs. It's just, I could read the newspaper if I want to read about oil-rich maniacs. But I feel like Dan Aykroyd's character over the course of several decades probably had at least 200 or 300 people killed.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty diabolical to me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It would have been fun to see a bus full of Hare Krishnas on the Mr. Bone. What is it called?
Mr. Bone Stripper.
That would have been a fun sequence, I think. I have nothing against Hare Krishnas, but they do lend themselves well to comedy. Like an airplane when the guy decks that guy for no reason.
Yeah.
The only one other thing I say about Aykroyd's direction is I found the car chase really slick, and I guess he picked that up from, you know, Blues Brothers.
Very good, that, yeah.
Good car chase. And the way it starts as well, so you have Chase and Moore and Taylor Negron, and they're all kind of having a conversation in the car, and it times it perfectly so that the cop car comes right up to their bumper just as Chevy Chase is touching the rearview mirror. Oh, that was really good. And then the end of the car chase is John Candy opens the Falkenvania PD car door right into shot. Mm. And I thought that was really cool as well. You saw this, Jesse. Chevy Chase had a really cool Falkenvania PD baseball cap when he went on Arsenio. So I think they must have been geared around marketing this movie as Falkenvania, and then that didn't come to be. So I think it's probably really last minute that it became Nothing But Trouble.
They really screwed the pooch in terms of marketing this movie. I even saw beautiful posters for this film that were originally designed.
National Lampoon style.
Like, they should have sold this thing as a horror movie called Falkenvania. Like, Falkenvania means nothing until the movie's a hit.
Exactly.
You know, it connotes Transylvania and it also weird European enclave in the United States. I like that idea, too, of this sovereign nation, like this town that lives by its own rules and has a crazy judge that can do whatever they like. And I also liked the little twist at the end when they escape and go get the police and they all take them to the farm, and then it turns out that they're all friends.
That was great.
I thought that was a good idea too.
Another movie that's just sprung to mind in this kind of similar vein that I really like is The Burbs. I think is starting to get a bit of a following.
I like The Burbs.
Yeah, these weirdo, we're European, but Europeans in America, there's always something a little bit unnerving about them, right? It's just, what are these guys up to?
That's the joke in Fargo, because everybody is weirdly Scandinavian. But I think they should have called it Falkenvania. They should have just gone for it, you know, like market this thing as a horror comedy instead of not being sure exactly what it is, you know. It's a movie for nobody.
Yeah.
Around the world, it was still called Falkenvania.
Yeah.
If you go on YouTube, you can find the German language trailer for this movie. It actually seems like it works better if it were dubbed in another language, but it's called Falkenvania in Germany.
Falkenvania. Yeah, it'd be fun to watch the German dub, I bet. I think as much as he had creative control on this, Dan Aykroyd's vision didn't make it to the cut that we saw. And one of the things I think is really telling is the opening. Because it spends a lot of time establishing New York, and then it's not set in New York. I think maybe they wanted to make people feel like, oh yeah, this is Dan Aykroyd, it's Saturday Night Live, you love this, and it's not that.
It
also never resolves what Demi Moore's character wanted to go to Atlantic City for exactly. That's the whole pretext for traveling across the country, and then it never pays off in any way whatsoever.
The amount of parts like that are not resolved, you know, they're countless throughout. Why does Digital Underground and Tupac Shakur pop up?
And he loves them.
Yeah.
He bloody loves them, the judge.
The only reason, I think, is Danny Aykroyd just loved hip-hop.
Right.
On Arsenio, he comes in wearing, like, a Run DMC hat and doing the dance as he comes in. God. And you know Run DMC did the Ghostbusters 2 rap.
Right, yeah.
You know, let's not talk about Trading Places.
But I think Digital Underground, while we're on it, have the best line in the film. They say, man, will you look at this place? It's extremely draculated.
Yeah.
They didn't know what they had when they had Tupac on the set. I guess he might have been 18 or 19. But there's a shot where they're all in front of the judge and Tupac is cut off on the left side of the screen. It's like they was like, you've got a movie star on your hands here.
Yeah.
You don't know what you've got. I mean, in about 2 years, he's going to be huge.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And also one big laugh for me in this movie, because I was surprised at one funny part where Daniel Baldwin pulled a gun on John Candy when they were in front of the trunk of the police car. And then perfect comic timing. John Candy suddenly produces an Uzi and tucks it under his arm. I thought that was very well deployed. I laughed out loud. I would love to read an oral history of the making of this film.
Yeah, I bet the footage is around somewhere and, you know, they could make a really good documentary out of it as well. That could be Dan Aykroyd's second movie.
Maybe Peter Jackson can re-edit
it. Yes, Peter Jackson. Yeah, let's have it on Disney Plus.
Can you imagine?
Still want to do the
favorite lines and stuff?
Yeah, do we want to do that or do we want to move?
I have some if you want to hear them.
Okay, let's hear Craig's favorite lines.
Am I the only one who has any?
Yeah, I haven't got any.
I've got some.
I think I gave
one. Okay. So my favorite line from Joan Candy is when Taylor Negron is trying to convince him to side with him and his sister and help them escape. And he says something like, oh, you look like you need a holiday. And John Candy says, you peeled the correct banana there. And my favorite line from Dan Aykroyd, the judge, is when Chevy lights up his cigar and Dan Aykroyd barks, put out that dog rocket. So, what the fuck's a dog rocket? I've never heard that phrase before in my life. They're not funny, but I like them.
I don't know, those are some good lines, yeah. I like when we first meet the Brazilians and he says, they're Brazilianaires.
Yeah.
They have breakfast at 2 p.m.
I was confused because they showed their passports and they were both Argentine passports.
Right.
And they're speaking Spanish as well.
Yeah. By the way, R.I.P. Taylor Negron, I love him. And,
great. Yeah.
Later that year, he played Milo, the terrible villain in The Last Boy Scout. With lots of great lines. But he's always a great presence, and it was a really smart idea to put him in the film.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I got one more line from Chase, where Demi Moore has just left him alone in the lift and he says, thanks for the espresso maker and the bag of shit.
Yeah.
I guess she was walking a dog or something.
Yeah.
Anybody else have any lines they would like to add?
Everybody else hated the film.
I've shared my lines. Joe, I didn't hate it. I certainly wasn't bored.
No.
No.
It's fascinating, right?
Yeah. What's going on? It's just that none of it makes any sense.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I like looking at comedy from a scientific perspective. So like, where did this go wrong? Why is this funny?
Yeah.
Why is this thing that's not funny actually kind of funny on a different level?
Mm.
Yeah. And things like that. You know, like I'm not actually enjoying myself, but I am clinically interested in why this thing went so wrong and looking for ways to make it better as well. Like, you know, it's like, Dan, if you're interested, we could work on a director's cut of Nothing But Trouble. I need to see some of the other footage. I bet you cut some good stuff out. Hmm. Let's see some of the gore that you were forced to remove.
With the improv dialogue, maybe there are takes where there are some really funny lines, but they were so, how should I say, off color that they weren't allowed to put them into the finished result.
Before we go any further, I'd like to thank you for listening to our show so far. So I will! No one's flipping stopping me. So thank you. And equally, nobody is stopping you from sharing the gift of laughter with your friends, enemies, and strangers. What do you have against laughter? Recommend Diabolical to anyone who will listen, even if you think they'll hate it. We want you to get the show in as many ears as possible, and you can help us do so with just a few words. Come and bother us on socials at DiabolicalPod and enjoy our fancy website, www.diabolicalpod.com. God bless you all.
This is the part of the show where the panel of peril compete for the title of Most Diabolical. We'll each vote for our favourite, and at the end, the person with the most votes will be crowned the winner of this special episode. But do remember, you cannot vote for yourself, you saucy babies. Our task this week is to take out our grudges against bankers on our latest prisoners and seek reparations for the coal deal that robbed us of our family fortune, in whatever form would satisfy. So, let's do this! And we'll begin with this week's guest, Jesse.
So, I have to try and out evil Valkenheiser.
That's right.
I don't know if that's possible. He's like 200 or 300 deaths ahead of me on this list. I think that I would have been more merciless on the bankers than Valkenheiser is. He let them live for a day or so. He immediately put to death those drug dealers. Why he left our main characters alive for a day, maybe he was toying with them like a cat, you know, breaks the legs of a rat before he finally puts them out of their misery, sort of thing. I would have had them publicly executed.
Wow.
And I would have maybe done a live stream, kind of like how Bane had people killed in The Dark Knight Rises to make sure that everybody knew that he was in control. I would have used this as an opportunity to sort of have sort of the Branch Davidian sect, you know, get the ATF after me and stuff like that. I would make an example of these bankers. This was post Wall Street crash of the late 80s. So, you know, if I already have my own sort of sovereign nation that answers to no one, I think this would be the moment that I would up my game.
Yeah.
Right.
So that would be my evil plan. I would not have the mercy that Valkenheiser had on Chevy Chase. I might also execute him just for being Chevy Chase.
And you'd be right to do so.
Well, Valkenheiser already executes people through Mr. Bone Stripper, which is pretty creative.
But not public.
I imagine if he was going to do something more public, it would be even more creative. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Maybe a live cam on Mr. Bone Stripper, like inside the actual charnel house. Yeah.
They must have had satellite broadcasts then, I guess.
Yeah.
I remember one thing you pointed out is Chevy Chase has GPS in this, and it was like the first ever GPS.
Oh, wow. Green screen. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah. That's one curiosity about this movie is that this might be the first movie outside of maybe The Living Daylights to have a GPS system on a car.
Mm.
It's not exactly GPS. It was stored maps that had to be actually manually entered into these systems.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
he mentions the map runs out, doesn't he?
Right.
Yeah. Because you have to actually enter the map information into the computer manually.
Right.
And it wasn't like the way that we can track movements now. I learned a little something doing research for this, that systems like this used the nautical navigational term dead reckoning, which I always think of as a Tom Cruise movie. But what dead reckoning is you determine the vehicle's initial position, its speed, and its direction to determine the new position.
Oh, wow.
So it's an educated guess. It's not an accurate scientific thing. But this was the stuff of a madman's dreams in 1991.
Yeah.
But now all of our cars have it. So Dan Aykroyd was a visionary, is what I'm saying.
So I could see the live stream working. I think that's possible. And that's an interesting idea because you kind of sanctify the sovereignty of your state. Is that worth more than the coal money would have been? After all, what is money but power?
Yeah, come and get me. That would be the statement I'd be making. As drunk with power, as Dan Aykroyd is in this film. This is a man not to be messed with. He seems to, as we discover at the end of the movie, he's got the police in his pocket too.
Yeah.
Not just the local corrupt cops, but like The neighboring town all love him too.
There's a bee's nest behind you. Okay. Any more questions for Jesse?
I like it.
Then let's move on and hear Ben's plan.
Judge Alvin Valkenheiser knows exactly what buttons to press to get what he wants. He's aware that Chris Thorpe holds a deep respect for successful businessmen, and so Valkenheiser sets his sights on the most bigly pioneer of early 90s capitalism, Donnie Tangerine Skin Trump. He lures Trump to Valkenvania with the promise of a lucrative land deal. He pitches the idea of an undeveloped tract of land that could be transformed into a luxury resort and golf course. As Trump arrives to seal the deal, Valkenheiser rolls out the red carpet, and between discussions of land potential and investment returns, Valkenheiser proposes a unique deal to Trump. In return for a chunk of Valkenvania's land, Trump must use his legendary influence to persuade Thorpe to marry Eldona. With the stage set, Trump meets Thorpe and launches into his repertoire.
She's the best mechanic, believe me. Fixes things nobody else can fix. Huge talent. Her knowledge of cars? Tremendous. Absolutely the best. She'll turbocharge your life. Very smart, very talented. People are always saying this. You'd be lucky to have her. She makes Valkenvania great. Marrying her isn't just a deal, it's the deal of a lifetime. Look, here's the thing, Chris, she's a winner. And I know winners. Trust me.
Won over by Trump's enthusiastic endorsement, Thorpe agrees to the marriage, and once the nuptials are concluded, Trump prepares to finalize his land acquisition, but Valkenheiser has other plans. And soon Trump finds himself on Mr. Bone Stripper. Before he can protest, Trump is sent through the terrifying contraption, his pudgy corpse no match for the pneumatic grinders.
Hey! A happy ending.
Yeah, that's, you've just made a better world there, Ben. Also, Donald Trump is in the Bobby Brown video for On Our Own from Ghostbusters 2. Right. So there is a minor Trump-Dan Aykroyd connection here.
Right.
Who's the worst person in the Bobby Brown video for On Our Own? Bobby Brown or Donald Trump?
Bobby Brown.
I don't know. I might have to flip a coin. Can I tell you a funny malapropism? There was a reality show, Bobby and Whitney.
Yeah, oh, it's horrendous. God.
And I've never forgotten this incredible malapropism that Bobby Brown said on one episode. He said, you know, it never seems to amaze me what people say or whatever.
And I believe that. Yeah. Is Donald Trump a very persuasive man?
We're about to find out.
Have you read The Art of the Deal?
I haven't read The Art of the Deal, I have to admit.
Well, me neither, but I'm sure it's very persuasive. Have you seen his wives?
Yeah, that's Trump, his charisma, his riz.
I think Trump has charisma since he lost embarrassingly in 2020 and he's the candidate again.
Yeah.
He's going to probably win as well.
I long for the days where someone would lose an election and then we'd never see them again.
We all thought we were done with him.
We've got a similar situation in the US. We've got choice between two cheeks of the same arse in the UK and so is the US. So, you know.
Yeah.
And every now and then, Tony Blair pops up to haunt us.
Looking like the witch played by Angelica Houston.
He looks like is the priest from Poltergeist 3. The embodiment of the poltergeist. Jesus Christ. Every time I see him, I'm like, yeah, fucking hell.
Well, if there's no more questions for Ben, since he was the last person on the mic, let's hear Adam's plan next.
Darn it.
Confident. I like it.
Oh, yeah. Under duress, to avoid marrying a larger, nay, big-hearted woman, Chevy Chase suggests to Judge Shreve the one thing that any aggrieved American first thinks of when they are insulted, or when they are made to look like an idiot, or suffer some embarrassment after agreeing to something totally foreseeably stupid, or injured by burning their lips on coffee they bought 5 seconds previous, or their rights as a sovereign citizen are infringed. You guessed it. Chevy Chase suggests he sue and calls his lawyer. His lawyer recommends Jedediah Tucker Ward. He's just finished a particularly brutal case where his own daughter was his adversary. Jed has a history of taking up cases for clients who've been unjustly wronged and has been practicing law since the 1950s. After giving Jed an over-the-top sob story about Judge Valkenheiser being an old man at the end of his tether and struggling to hold the family estate together and children living in filth, Jed agrees to represent them. Jed argues in court that the deal initially agreed upon with Valkenheiser's family was flawed, that the company who made the deal omitted vital geological information that meant it was grossly undervalued. Upon conducting the geological survey of the coal mine, the findings therein were not subject to the requisite regulatory review, with due consideration given to the established protocols governing mineral extraction, such that any pertinent environmental impacts identified may necessitate appropriate remedial actions as stipulated where under applicable statutes and regulations henceforth, coal seams, crevices, orifices and belly buttons, etc., etc. As the trial judge nods along agreeing with every point Jed makes, he already knows that his logic is undeniable. Undeniable. He rules in favour of the Valkenheisers and they get $1 billion and live happily ever after.
Oh.
Bravo.
Fantastic.
Bravura, bravura.
I asked my partner Emma for some ideas for this and she said, why don't you look into some real case law? And I thought, that sounds really funny, but also like a lot of work. But you did it.
There's a lot. It stretches back over 100 years for the coal miners suing. They're suing each other. They sue the unions, sue the coal miners' unions for like $500 million and stuff like that. It's crazy. So I was like, oh, this is too complex to try. So I just thought I'd just chuck in a load of legal speak and hopefully bamboozle everybody.
Have you ever seen the medical adverts? You know, in most countries, you can't advertise medicine, but in America, you somehow you can advertise medicine on TV.
Yeah, oh yeah. Speak to your doctor.
Yeah, it always has a long list of side effects. Yeah. You could do that for a living.
Did you notice the lawyer was from another 1991 movie?
Jed, did you say his name was?
Yeah, Jed Ward.
Jedward?
It's from the movie Class Action, and it's from a friend of the show, Gene Hackman.
Okay. Yes.
Friend of the show.
Yeah. Friend of the show means we like him. We're not saying he's ever been on, we're just saying he's friend of the show.
We're the ones secretly taking photos of him wearing the same outfit weeks apart.
Let the man be an old man, is what I say.
He's a lovely old gent, and he's an absolutely superb actor, so...
It also rocks that he is still smoking at age 94.
Right, yeah.
They showed him coming out of a gas station with some smokes. It's like, come on.
There's really no reason to stop now.
Yeah, you know, that'll kill you, you know, Gene. You're 94 years old. I just want to tell you guys that in Canada, we don't have any of the fine print that they have on drug commercials in the United States, where they say side effects include, and then they go on for 45 seconds.
Yeah.
In Canada, they just say, ask your doctor about whatever.
Okay.
They're not allowed to show what the drug does. It's like they'll have a couple and, you know, they'll realize that they're alone and it's a Viagra ad. And then they don't say what they're going to do next. And then it says, ask your doctor about Viagra.
In America, if you ask your doctor, how does Viagra work? He tells you and then you get charged $450.
Yeah. He gets really excited. He phones the pharmaceutical company afterwards and says, we got another one.
We got one. Guarantee this will give you erection. Not a guarantee.
We're not allowed here to do that. Thank God.
Well then, let's move on and hear Craig's diabolical scheme.
Well, I'm going to tell my diabolical scheme from the perspective of Valkenheiser, so I'll be speaking as him.
Oh, go on then.
Well, 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 if it ain't my lucky day. My grandson went and snatched us up a slick city banker in a BMW, trussed him up like a lady hog at the county fair. Handsome fella too, face like a grinny, or what city folk would call a tree gopher, or a chipmunk. Could make a fine husband for my granddaughter, Aldona. Of course, a banker will inquire after a dowry, so I'll tell him he's set to inherit a fortune. Even though I already told him we got swindled and left flat broke, maybe that contradiction was explained in a deleted scene from my life. At any rate, I need to raise more funds than the steady stream of salvage can bear forth, and the kicker is, the boy Dennis got lucky on this hunt, nabbing not only this here banker, but also a pair of Brazilian millionaires. What was along for the ride like a sheet of shit paper, stuck and hitching on the sole of his shoe, and now dressed and served to me like a tater salad. How tempted I am to fling a pickle in the face of this young man. But I can see he's squirrely. So I throw my pickle up that leggy young lady instead, since she seems the best tempered of the bunch. Indeed, she takes the train gag with good humour, and that seems to clear the air. I know Dennis longs for a life away from Valkyvania. So for now, I forget about Eldona and focus on him. I got a good nose for a good match, and I remember to wear it to dinner. It's clear these Brazilians are as desperate to be released as he is. So I take the young Fausto aside and make a Faustonian pact with him. He and his sister will both marry my Dennis in exchange for their freedom, and make of their union a modern throuple. The banker will marry Eldona, but he's lippy. So first, I'll even him up and make him mute as she is, taking his silver tongue as a deposit. Finally, Legs will marry me, and we'll all of us jet off to paradise and leave this stinking coal pit to burn in our stead.
Nice. Yeah, I kudos for the impression. I like it. Yeah, very
so
nice impression.
He's getting him to marry some tree gophers, if I followed that correctly.
That's just the gist of what I said, yes.
Yeah, it's as coherent as the film.
It kind of raises another point that were the two Brazilians, were they brother and sister solely for the purpose of getting the sister to go off with John Candy at the end?
Ah.
Yeah, maybe.
They could have been a couple, right?
That looked like they shot that at the last minute.
Yeah.
Point. Yeah.
But I did like the ass grab at the very end of that shot. Yeah. I also thought it was kind of weird that those characters just left the movie for almost an hour.
Yeah.
It's like I forgot they were even in it. There was no need to come back to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suspect there's a lot of them on the cutting room floor as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a shame because, you know, I would have liked to have seen more of Dennis. I like that character. So
how do you persuaded Demi Moore's character to marry?
She's just into it.
All right. Just...
You can see right away she's into it.
She's loving it.
He says to her, doesn't he, in the court, he says something like, I'd like to get to know you more. And she says, oh, I'd like that. And he says, would you? I think she's just trying to be so amenable to him because she thinks that's the way to play him and get out of here. Like, she just, if Chevy Chase hadn't been there with his cigar and his bad attitude, she would have done whatever the judge asked to get out of that ticket, including marrying him and living with him forever. No, I think at this point they kind of suspect that they're in mortal danger.
Yeah.
I mean, they must, because the Brazilians jump out of a quite high window.
Because of the bones.
Yes, because of the bones.
Would you look at the bones?
Yeah, and the Soylent Green that they're fed.
Yeah. Okay, then I will bring us home with my scheme. I'm not going to do an accent. I can't do that accent for that long.
Come on. We've had two good voices
already.
I'm not
doing it. I'm like Richard Madeley. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it.
Do a different accent when we did. We did our episode on Speed. Gaz did his impression of Dennis Hopper.
Oh, beautiful.
He's done a great Al Pacino recently.
His Al Pacino is very good, but his Dennis Hopper is a gruff North Yorkshire accent.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Hey, lad.
Has to be heard to be believed. But in any case, I'm not doing an accent for this part. Okay.
Sport.
Judge Valkenheiser seems to have a bit of a nose on for fairground-themed stylings. As we have already discussed, the old court-slash-schoolhouse that he resides in is a regular funhouse of trapdoors, shrinking hallways, and helter-skelters. Likewise, his favoured method of dispatch, the Mr. Bone Stripper roller coaster, has the sweet tang of childhood uffery-buffery nonsense. Therefore, I propose that Chris, Diane, and those annoying Brazilians be sentenced to 10 years hard labour as fairground characters. You know, the type with the oversized heads who go around greeting people and doing other bits and bobs. If they don't comply with Valkenheiser's verdict, they'll take their last ride on good old Mr. Bone Stripper, naturally. Diane can work the refreshment stand and pose for photos with the local inbreds. The Brazilians can keep the guest facilities, principally the toilets, clean using only toothbrushes to make everything glistening. And Chris can take the place of a clown, sitting atop the fall-away chair above a dunk tank. Enduring this unique form of water torture is reparation enough, as he is constantly dropped into the drink by the massive, grotesque man-babies throwing tennis balls at the red and white target board to dunk the smarmy financial publisher. And that's it.
So you turn Valkenvania, or at least the Valkenheiser Mansion, into a sort of Disney World.
Yeah, I'd say it's halfway there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's halfway there, yeah, definitely.
But safer, the better accident record.
Nothing could possibly go wrong.
You guys put so much thought into your diabolical plans where I just raced ahead into the Saddam Hussein levels. David Koresh levels of destroying everyone and starting a war with the rest of the United States.
We're nearly 100 episodes in now, so
yeah.
Preparation's all we have at this point. Yeah, yeah. We ran out of steam for coming up with things off the cuff a while ago.
We usually just throw dicks and shit into the plots if we've run out of ideas. Normally.
Well, that's what Dan Aykroyd did in the, the earlier cut of this movie. The R-rated, the too hot for theaters version.
Well, those plans were nose-nobblingly diabolical. We had Jesse's overkill come and get me plan with public executions. We had Ben's Donald Trumpian bone stripping plan. Adam's large $1 billion court settlement plan. Craig's triple wedding where everybody was wedded off to various family members. And we had my Disney theme park plan. But there can only be between one and five winners. So with that, if we could all cast our votes, please.
I don't have a pen and paper on me, so...
That's okay.
But I know who my winner is.
We'll do it on the honor system.
Okay. Let's hear who Jesse voted for.
I really liked Adam's, but I'm voting for Ben's.
Oh.
Adam gets silver.
I don't need your pity.
But you'll take it.
When the legalese came in, I was like, okay, now I got to decide who do I prefer, Ben or Adam? But I'm going with my initial take, and it's Ben.
Thank you very much.
One on the board for Ben.
The best thing about Ben's, I forgot to say when we were asking questions, is he said of Judge Valkenheiser, he knows exactly what buttons to press to get what he wants, which he literally does.
Yeah.
Especially if what he wants is shrimp salad on his hot dog. Yeah.
And Ben's would result in a better world for us all. I know that's not very diabolical, but Trump is, so let's get rid of Trump. So.
Murder is wrong, so.
I think so. I agree with you.
There'd be a lot less unintentional comedy in the world, though, if we got rid of Trump.
Someone else will come along.
He's a very funny man.
Yeah.
Not
he sure is. You just wish that Trump would be content to just, you know, have a three-week stand at the Riviera in Vegas and just tell comedy for an hour and a half, like insult comic. It's too bad he wants to be president, though. You know, like he will say something and you'll be like, that's funny. It's too bad that he's a nightmare. But yeah. I could imagine having a beer with him.
God, I don't know whether I'd go that far.
Yeah, no.
I can imagine it being a very awkward beer.
Well, maybe I'll glass him at the end of the drink. I like Trump when he sells out the people that are enabling him. Like, I don't like him as much when he's going like after the rest of the country, but when he's going after his fellow Republicans, I love him. Like, did you guys ever know about Diamond and Silk? There were these two women called Diamond and Silk who were black women who were huge fans of Donald Trump, and they were always cheering for him, and they were always having photos taken with him. And then one of them died. And Trump mentioned at the funeral that he never met her, but she sounded like a great lady, even though he totally met her many times at her funeral. And they had to pretend that that was fine. Like, it's just so incredibly rude, but they just can't criticize him. Yeah. So they have to instead let him insult them to their faces. Mm-hmm. And I love it.
Yes, great.
Okay, let's hear who Ben voted for.
Well, I vote for the plan that conjured the funniest image, which was the two men babies throwing tennis balls at Chevy Chase. So I voted for Gaz.
Hooray!
Yay!
Well, in that case, I shall reveal my vote, and I have voted for Adam.
Oh!
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Made the most sense to me.
It made no sense.
So, let's hear who Adam voted for.
Well, purely on the strength of an excellent impersonation of Dan Aykroyd's character, Judge Shreve, I have voted for Craig.
Oh, my Lord, would you look at that?
Excellent, excellent impression.
Wow. This could be a five-way tie, or we might have a winner, depending on who Craig has voted for.
Well, I had to go with the one that made me laugh the most. And bizarrely, that was the one with all the legalese. So, Adam, you're the winner.
Hey! Oh, well
done. You deserve it.
See? I didn't need your pity after all. You,
you almost had my vote, Adam. And it wasn't pity.
Well, I didn't need it. Just saying.
Well, that will do us for another batch of evil schemes. But like James Bond, we shall return. And like James Bond, some of our adventures will entertain and others will disappoint, but may be reassessed in the future. Once again, we'd like to thank our special guest, Jesse Hawken, for taking the time to join us and share his evil scheme too. Where can the Peril Pals hear more of your diabolical thoughts, Jesse?
Well, I'm still on Twitter under the name of Jesse Hawken. I'm also on Blue Sky.
X.
No, I'm never calling it that. If he's allowed to dead name trans people, then we're allowed to dead name Twitter.
Yes.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. Also, he still calls it Twitter, I think. I'm sure he must
be. Yeah.
Whenever they're in court, they refer to it as Twitter.
Yeah, it's very funny.
In front of the judge. So, but anyway, I'm still there, and I'm on Blue Sky as well. And Junk Filter is my podcast, available wherever podcasts are listened to. And I also have a Patreon. People who support the show directly get bonus episodes monthly.
Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful podcast.
It is. It's excellent. Really good
podcast. I understand I got name checked on a recent episode of your show.
It's true.
Yes.
Yeah. Our Francis Ford Coppola's, Gary Oldman's, Bram Stoker's Dracula episode. And Gaz had been listening to your episode on that same film.
I gleaned some important information from that,
yeah,
as I always do from your podcast, Jesse. Yeah. It's yeah, excellent. Well worth listening to.
Thank you very much.
What I usually get from it is I'll just disappear completely into something, like that time you made me watch every episode of Miami Vice. But it was so cool.
Oh, did I vice pill you?
You vice pilled me, yeah, yeah.
Oh, and I'm... There's a few more. I'm doing some more because I still have more to say about that show because it's turning 40 this year.
It still holds up, wow. Totally. It's great.
Yeah. Are they doing a new movie as well?
Are they?
There's always talk of that, yeah.
I think so.
A sequel to the other movie?
Yeah, or a new fresh one, I think. I think I saw something about it. I don't know.
Yeah, I was getting messages from people saying, God damn it, I just ordered the box set. I didn't know how good this show was.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You're costing me a lot of money listening to your show.
Join us next time when we will be joined by our special guest, Chris Tapley of the 50 Mile Per Hour podcast, which talks all about the film Speed. And we will be discussing one of Hollywood's great sequel misfires, Speed 2. Should be a good time. Until then, remember, everything will be all right in the end, and if it isn't all right, then it isn't the end.
I was hoping you were going to ask me who my favorite Bond villain was.
Oh, well, we should.
Yeah, we'd love to know.
Who is your favorite Bond villain?
Oh, it's Hugo Drax, absolutely.
I knew.
Oh, well, yeah, there we go. We've done Moonraker, so check it out.
Moonraker's
yeah,
such a great film.
Did you know that it was originally going to be James Mason as Hugo Drax? But
oh, wow,
he couldn't do it.
Bloody hell.
That would have been incredible. Oh,
yeah, I love yeah, James Mason, yeah.
He would have said, Mr. Bond, you appear with the tedious inevitability of an unloved season. Would have been so good.
Yeah, wow.
Look after Mr. Bond. See that some harm comes to him. Oh, God. So good.